You're listening to a special episode of The Break Breakdown. I'm here with Courtney Romano, who will be co-hosting the episode today with me, Benjamin Shaw. All season long, we've been talking about the process of making Kinsley Verses, our web series, which is currently streaming on YouTube. Safe to say that independent filmmaking is a major undertaking, and it's a process that is subjective and deeply personal, and it's creative and it's practical, and it's worthy of hearing from other artists who have gone through their own versions of a process for their project. So today, we're going to talk with a guy who stars, directs, and produces in his own feature, Anchorage. His name is Scott Monahan. His film, Anchorage, co-stars Dakota Loesch, who also wrote the script. The story is about two brothers who attempt to drive a car full of opioids from Florida to Alaska. The film is epic, and it's unexpected. I hope you enjoy today's conversation.
You know, I had this fear when I was starting, when I decided that I was going to be directing Anchorage, and I didn't go to film school. I don't know all of the technical jargon. You know, most of my experience is from being on set as an actor, and directing specifically theater and more performance art kind of stuff. So working in film, I just had this unease that was coming. And when we found our DP, I expressed this to her and I said, listen, I want to be the best director for you that I can be, but I just need to let you know what my limitations are. And I'm ready to learn and I'm excited to learn and like grow in this. And she just stopped me. She was like, Scott, it's okay. That's my job. It's my job to translate what you want and what your vision is into the technical stuff. And it just made me feel so at ease and so confident that Dakota and I had made the right decision with our DP, because that's a very important part of the filmmaking process, is surrounding yourself with a team that is supportive and trying to support them.
That's one reason I love working, broadly speaking, in production, but with other artists, I guess, because in the best, even actually in like the mediocre scenario, every artist or department is aware of what they bring to the table and why they're there. And that response that you get, it should calm you, but also it's the right one. It's the one you should expect, that the person who's there for a specific job is going to, you know, reassure you that they're there and that you don't have to be conversant in 12 different languages,
yeah,
in order to do the job or in order to be an effective artist, in order to create your work.
Yeah, I agree.
I also think that there's this enormous amount of pressure to put the title director next to your name. It's this weird, like, unconscious thing that I don't know if other people feel this, but I feel like, oh, if I'm putting that title right next to my name, that means that I have the answers. And the thing is that I don't think directors don't have the answers. I think you just can't know what your answers are until you're in the moment and someone asks you the question. And then even if you are a technical director versus a narrative director, say, for film, you're still going to, like, in the moment, be brought up against so many different elements and so many different questions that the director is really the vision, right? You hold the vision. And for you, you were executive producer, your director, your star, your marketing. I mean, you are the film. The film is you, right? There's like very, like the tentacles reach back and forth, right? Between like you as the person who's producing the art and then creating the art and having the vision for the, not only the art, but for the trajectory of the art. So can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know that a lot of our audience and our listeners will have to be doing it all. They don't have a choice because of money or connections or whatever, or they're doing it for the first time. And so they really have to do it themselves. Can you talk about a little bit about your experience of wearing all of those different hats?
Yeah. Well, first off, it's as much as all of those things are true in some way, you know, this is Dakota and I's vision from the very beginning. And it started in that way of us sharing our views on what types of films we liked, the story that we wanted to tell, and the specific ethos that we wanted to have on set of supporting people, being kind to people, creating a safe environment, especially for such a violent and intense and dark film, maybe even an anxiety-inducing film. We wanted to make sure that the set experience, the on-set experience, the lived experience for these people is not going to be reflective of the same material that's in the film. I am the EP, and a lot of the funding and financial stuff came from me, but also Dakota has been there with me from day one as a producer as well. And we worked on it together, really trying to understand the full trajectory of the film, starting with our initial idea into what that would look like on set, and then developing that into a feature. And then as we are working on the feature in every step of the process, I think it's really important to be looking ahead, but also staying present. It's so important. You need to know what movies are out, what movies are on the festival track, which movies have been released that are akin to yours, and find ways that you can buck expectations within the genre or within the subject matter that you're dealing with, and ways that you can lean into those things that people expect. But I think that for me, it was all about compartmentalization, with still the foresight of the future of saying, you know, when it came to directing this film, I came to Dakota because we had developed it together. And I said, I really want to direct this. When you talk about the filmmaker being the, you know, our editor, Spencer Showalter, said that you are the translator of the dream, and you're also mm-hmm. the dreamer. And each of those people that come in are translating as well. And what we started to find out is that the film, once we started creating this idea and birthing it into the world, it started to have a voice of its own. And I was seeing it in my dreams. We were seeing it in music and movies that we were watching, and it was starting to speak to us through that. And I think it's your job as a filmmaker and as a director to find out who sometimes the film is speaking through, because it's not always you. Sometimes it could be a stranger on the street. It could be somebody on your crew. Our team throughout the film production had so many ideas that came up that was like, oh, that's the film talking right there. It doesn't matter who it came from.
I wasn't going to go here, but I'm wondering, do you work intuitively when you're making a film like this? Is there a kind of, I don't want to say protocol or method, but like for you to kind of be in that liminal space with the film? Or is it just like, I'm thinking about it all the time, so I'm noticing things?
I think it's a little bit of both. It is definitely pervasive and has been for almost 4 years now. It comes back to Anchorage every yeah. every other thought, it seems like. And that's slowing down a little bit now that the release is done. I think so. Dakota and I met each other in the warehouse downtown LA immersive art scene, immersive theater specifically. And if you're not aware of what that is, it's kind of where you take the seats out and you get to walk through the experience. And the companies that I started working with, and then one that we worked on together, one of them is called Ceaseless Fun. We create collaboratively devised work. So we come in with a concept, an idea, and maybe some poems to pull through from, and we would also self-generate a lot of content. So we got very used to walking into a rehearsal day, having no idea what we were going to do, or walking into a role and having no idea who we were, and finding that through the process. So Dakota and I did 5 shows together and got really comfortable in working in that space of the unknown and listening to your intuition and gut and listening to how it's reacting in the room, and also pulling in pieces of ourselves because we were writing so much of our own content as well. And so that translated into our film production, and we put together a team of people that work in immersive. So my partner, Meredith Trinan, is a producer and also a director, and she worked on a lot of the shows that we did. And Erin Nafee is our cinematographer. She's a huge fan of immersive, so she comes from the other perspective. and our production designer, Perry Powell. He was, when I first started in immersive at this warehouse called Play, he was part of that crew. And then our editor even was, he was working in that space with us as well, and our composer. So we were kind of building together a team of people that knew how to work and live in that space so that we could have as much structure as we needed and then give ourselves the room for that uncertainty and play.
Piggybacking on Court's question, I guess practically speaking, I'm wondering what's in the script.
It was not a fully improvised film. I mean, our script was 48 pages that we went out with. There's a lot in our script. And when you watch the movie, there's big chunks of it that don't really have a lot of dialogue. And that was written into the script ahead of time. So we knew exactly what was going to happen, where they were going, the words that were going to be said. And we really just left the tail slates basically of every, just like the end part of every scene to let it run a little bit. And Dakota and I could let that run forever. And it would be either Meredith or Aaron being like, okay, guys, we're good. We're like, all right, cool.
We got to move on. And
yeah. And the funny thing is oftentimes that stuff that ran on wasn't what we used in the script, but it was beneficial and useful for Dakota and I on set. And we had made sure that the scenes that we wanted to have some fluidity and some discovery, that we blocked that amount of time for those scenes. And the scenes that we knew exactly what they were and the objective of the scene, it was very clear, and those kind of things, we would maybe give a little less time for those. I mean, we shot this in 5 days, so we only had, you know, like sometimes only 2 takes each to get a shot.
So you shot in 5 days. There's something really epic about the film, certainly like the setting and also the emotional life of the characters. Did you choose spaces, basically, like, it seems like to me, abandoned spaces and like the desert that you would have full ownership over as a practical move because it allowed you to film for 5 days for free and also, you know, light? And I mean, I'm kind of wondering like the logistics of filming something that to me seems really grand in 5 days. And
yeah,
how you navigated that.
That was the really fun part for me and Dakota, was to think about, it all comes down to budget, I guess, in the beginning, is how much money do we have to shoot this thing? And also the story. So what Dakota and I did with this script specifically and this story was that we knew who these characters were and the story that we wanted to tell. And we were trying to figure out what part of the story we would tell, because the story is about these two brothers driving a trunk full of stolen opioids from Florida, their home, to Alaska. And so there could have been a film that started in Florida and went all the way. That would have been a much bigger budget film. Or it could have just been a part of them in Florida or a different part of their trip. But we decided, based on our budget and also doing some of our character work, where are these characters from? When we decided they were from Florida, which we have a lot of connections to, we thought it would be interesting to pick up the story in the most intense part of their trip. So towards the end, as they're getting closer to the destination. And that also worked for us in a logistical sense, because it was in California, which is where we live. And I had talked to some filmmaker friends, which is something that I highly recommend anyone doing that's going to make their first feature, is to talk to people that have made their first features and say, where did your money go? And opening up their books in a very practical sense of like, can I see where you spent your money? And locations was one of those things that often cost a lot of money. And so I had said to Dakota, hey man, there's a bunch of abandoned buildings up the 395. Let's go on a tour and just see what we find. So we took a 2-day trip and we drove up and found all the locations. And the locations that we found that are in the film happened to be perfect for the story and also logistically along the way up north. So once we started to figure that, oh, not only do these locations work and the locations kind of go back in time, we put our producer hats on and said, okay, so we can shoot this chronologically. We can bring the crew along for the entire duration of the story, more like a theater production. They get to see the beginning to the end. The buildings are going back in time, which is what we love. And also we can do this in a way that we don't have to go, we're not bopping back and forth for coverage or pickups. And by shooting with all natural light, free locations, and having that kind of it was only 2.5 hour range from the first location to the last. It made the first feature for us to be very feasible.
That checklist is so extraordinarily convenient that I want to say, like, also to your earlier point, it's like allowing the film spoke to you, and therefore a lot of things not fell into place, but became apparent, it sounds like to me, which made the project or the process rather a really, like, it sounds like a really meaningful one, or the one that you had hoped to create when you set out to film this thing.
I think there was a point, and I talked about this earlier. Matthew McConaughey has a whole book on green. I think it's called Green Lights or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's just part of what he's talking about. But the idea that if you keep getting red lights on a project, either, you know, shopping it around to friends as an idea or the script, you just keep fighting uphill against it. And then you get into production and it's like, I'm not saying give up, but if you're seeing the green lights and they keep opening up for you, you're on the right path. And there was talking again about the intuitive nature of filmmaking and kind of my ethos in that as well, is that the film was like, I want to be made, and this is how I would like to be made. This is where I would like to be shot.
Mm-hmm. You know? I have a friend who says, one door opens the next. So it's like when a project opens a door and you walk through it, you don't know. I mean, this is like a perfect metaphor for the setting and scene of your feature. When you walk into a room, you don't necessarily know what you're going to find. But if it keeps opening, if there's another door in that room and you keep opening it, every move that you make can build this film. And I think it's a really great point to underline for new filmmakers or filmmakers who feel like outside of the system, which, like, is me. I'm talking to me, Scott. But it's a good reminder to say you're not going to have everything at the beginning, and you don't need it. You know, the whole headlight metaphor, you only need to see as far as your headlights will take you, and you can make the whole journey that way. And also, cool. There's also something fun about it. I mean, as you know, we're constantly, I think, people who want to make movies are, to your point earlier, dreamers. And practitioners, I should say. So it's like we've got that dreamy part that we need to live in and obey, and it can help guide us in the practice and logistics of doing the thing. You've played theatrically, which is more than I think a lot of young independent filmmakers can say, even filmmakers who've completed a feature, which again is even a smaller number. I think playing theatrically is an even tinier number. So can you speak to a little bit of how you've used, like, forgive me, I'm going to coin it, the intuitive filmmaking process that you use, or intuitive artistic process, along with the foresight that you talked about with self-distribution, and how you looked at that practical road and how you mapped that self-distribution journey for yourself in this process?
Yeah, I think something that I realized pretty early on is that I had a business mind of navigating money and finances and how systems work. It's really interesting to me. It's something that I really love to nerd out about and dive into. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I have any great financial advising in my personal life. I'm working on that. But as far as understanding how things work, it helps me. And I think any time that you're walking through the unknown, most of my fears and insecurity come from things that I don't know. So why am I still feeling this insecurity or this fear about how my crew is going to eat on set? I can't even wrap my head around it. And I called my producer and she said, Scott, we have that covered. And it just released and alleviated that for me. And so when you don't have that and you're navigating the world of distribution and the business side of things, there is so many resources. I listened to the A24 podcast, which was super helpful. Sundance had this thing. I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but the Independent Distribution Lab or Fellowship, where films would get a grant to independently distribute their film, and then they would keep track of everything and have an essay that would kind of explain their journey and their path. And so I read all of those. And one of them was Jim Cummings. And I heard about what happened with Thunder Road and his whole journey and his theatrical distribution. And I actually called him. I hit him up and through a friend of a friend, and he did a call with me and illuminated some of that part for me. But for us in theatrical, I knew how important that is for me as an audience member of going to see movies in theater, and what it feels like. And what we wanted with this film was to create a film that people would see in theaters, right? And I think that sometimes we get that experience through film festivals and we say, well, I got that experience, now let's just release it. And our film festival journey was about 2 years long. We went to 17 film festivals, and that part of that process was because our sales agent that we had brought on pretty early and I and Dakota had decided that we wanted to wait to partner with the right people, and that we wanted to release in more than just the US. And mm-hmm. we wanted to time that release together and sync it up. So we were waiting to try to get at least one other country so that they could release at the same time and be new. But when it came to the theatrical distribution, we reached out to a company that was a booker, a theatrical booking agent. And it was at a time when I just got our deliverables due date. It came up to me just out of nowhere. We were working on a contract for months, and then the contract was signed, and it was like, you have 60 days to get all these deliverables in. And my team wasn't around. They were on other projects. So I had to spend a lot of money and all the insurances and copyrights mm-hmm. and clearances and the paperwork and all these things that we had kind of left in a back burner for a couple of years. And at that time, we had a pretty great deal with this theatrical booking agent, but potentially it could cost us a lot more than it would make. And I was in this place of deep anxiety, the mm-hmm. worst place I think I've ever been in my life. For 2 days, I couldn't sleep. And on this one day, every time I closed my eyes, I was thinking about, I had guaranteed this to our UK distributor that we would have a US theatrical release, but I don't feel like I can financially make this decision. And I was just in this spin. And I woke when it was finally like 5 a.m. My mom lives on the East Coast, thankfully. And I was like, I can now call my mom, not at like 4 a.m. and be like, help
make
me.
Her be like, what? Are you okay?
Yeah.
Like 4 a.m. call.
Yeah, exactly. And I called her and she helped me get my mooring in myself. Because to be completely honest, and this is maybe more the pressures of deliverables than it was the theatrical distribution financial thing, but I had never been closer to the thing that kept playing for me in my head was the only way to not feel this feeling, because these things are happening whether you want them or not, is to just not be here. And that's scary, right? It's like, yeah. I've never had those thoughts before. And it really helped to talk to my mom. And it got me into this place where it's like, okay, Scott, that is not the only option here. There are other options. And I can just pull out of anything that doesn't feel good for me at any stage, you know? Mm-hmm. And so,
yeah.
We pulled back on the theatrical, and I talked to some other directors that said, you had the run. It's going to release on VOD. People will see it. We pulled back. I focused on deliverables. And then when I had my bearings back, I said, okay, I still want to do it, but I want to do it differently. How can we do that? And yes. we partnered with, I went to my producer, Gia Rigoli. She's incredible. She's a film independent Imaginar producer fellow right now. And she was a Berlinale Talents fellow. Like she's just a killer. And I met her up just to talk about my plan for theatrical distribution. And she said, we'll cover that. And she basically covered our week-long run that was in Los Angeles. And so with that done, I was like, okay, that's week one. That will qualify us for awards. We'll have a week in our home city. And that run was incredible. And then we moved on to reaching out to other theaters and trying to go back to Dakota's hometown of Chicago. And we reached out to the Music Box Theater just to rent their theater. And they came back and said, we love this movie. We want to book it for a week straight. Are you okay with a 50-50 split? So no upfront costs at one of the coolest theaters in Chicago.
Yeah.
And then once we got that, we started having this movement. And I had a call with our distributor where I said to them, listen, I need 3 months before our VOD release date so I can do our theatrical tour. Because what Dakota and I wanted to do was replicate film festivals and go to each city 1 week at a time, be at every screening, Q&A every time. And that led us to New York. And then our UK distributor, because we did our US theatrical run, got us in 15 Curzon cinemas in London. And we played in multiple theaters, even outside of London, for most of September. And it felt so good to have this plan, to have that anxiety and that swell of like, Scott, you're overextending yourself. You still have your film debt. You still have this deliverables debt, and you're trying to double down. And I was getting no's from some people I reached out to for money for that stage at that time. And when I pulled back and reassessed and came back with a new plan, then all the doors opened. And that was very affirming of the release of that. And also just seeing like there's something intuitive in this process that you really have to listen to yourself. Sorry, that was a lot.
I so appreciate, I imagine I speak for Court as well, how candid you're being, because there's a practical thing that happens in the process. You know, it's inside the work, and it's really cool to hear you talk about it.
I think that's like my job is to do, I don't want to say it's my job, but it feels important to me to share that, because I feel like sometimes us as filmmakers, especially when we're starting out, feel like if we share our pitfalls, if we share the losses, if we share that there was stress or that there was no's along the way, that the perception is going to be that we shouldn't have made it in the first place, or we're not at the level to do that thing. And I think for me, if I can help people understand how difficult it is, but also that you surround yourself with a team and a support system, and that you and your own voice is important, and we all have that intrinsic, beautiful voice that is completely and uniquely our own, that we can work our way through it, you know?
And we get more interesting, valuable work out there. I mean, like, we get to see stories that wouldn't be told if someone felt like, you know, oh, well, who am I to do that? Or I don't know the self-distribution process, so I can't try it. It's like, sure you can. Mm. You know how many people have a lot of zeros next to their bank accounts and are making weird, crazy, random decisions every day? This is how the world works, you know? And it's, yeah. Also as filmmakers, we are so insulated and siloed that it is so helpful to hear, again, speaking from my own position, like, it is so helpful for me to hear you talk about that and describe that, because although we had different circumstances when we made our things, I 100% didn't sleep for 2021 or 2022. And it wasn't because of my children those years. This year, it's because of my children. But, you know, it's so relatable and so true. I want to talk about where you and maybe you and Dakota are going with your career and what's coming next, because this is obviously a super personal story. And just one thing that I wanted to add in here, you know, Benji mentioned that it's an epic. It's got that fabric of epicness. And I think it's because it's so specific. I think when we drive down into those specifics, like you guys did with this, that's why an audience member can say, this was so hard to watch. Thank you for making it, you know. And that is the artistic side of, I mean, that's our soul, right? That's, there are so many reasons not to make a film. That's one really good reason that can trump all the other reasons not to make a film, which is like, it's just so effing hard. But I want to talk about that kind of in terms of where you're going. I'm so curious about how other filmmakers kind of scaffold their career. And obviously making a feature film is a huge endeavor. It's a huge milestone for a filmmaker. I guess I want to leave it open-ended and just ask, what are you building towards?
Well, to be completely honest, I didn't really think I would be a film director. You know, I have been an actor my whole life. I went to a conservatory and studied that. And yeah, I made a short film in 2017 from a writer's group that I was in. And before I joined that writer's group, I didn't really think of myself as a writer. And then I wrote something and I was like, well, this is actually kind of cool. I could shoot this. And then I made that. And then Anchorage was started off as what was going to be a short film where Dakota and I maybe go out and shoot it on a iPhone or something and turned into a feature. And then that became something that I felt the confidence to direct. And so for me going forward in this present moment is the separation from the project, because I think that as an artist, I heard it at the Jim Thorpe Film Festival, this panel was talking about, you can learn all the technical stuff, but what you can't learn is your aesthetic and your taste. And you build that by looking at all different types of art, reading books, watching movies, painting, pottery, poetry, avant-garde stuff, watching gonzo film, like it just like it's all in this world of creating what your aesthetic is. And for so many years, my aesthetic has been surrounded in my like Anchorage, the from font to verbiage to how things are edited, the music that surrounds that world. And I'm in this palette cleanse stage. I also am, like I said, an actor first. So I haven't had representation since like 2012. I was artistic director of a warehouse venue and then working in immersive theater and just kind of booking work on my own through connections. And I wanted to come back to that agency representation realm once I felt like I was ready for that. Because the funny thing is, I moved to LA and was like, somebody said I was green when I first moved there. And I was like, are you kidding me? I just had 4 years of conservatory training. I'm not green. I was so green. I feel like I am now at 35, no longer green anymore. And I know what that means. I don't think that it has to take everyone until they're 35. And I think that, not to say that I couldn't have done other things, but I am ready now for that, to shift back into that business mode as an actor. Mm-hmm. But I know that Dakota has multiple scripts that he's working on. He has a series about a carpet story with his family, and he's got features galore. And for me as a filmmaker and a director, my next film is also going to be very personal. I have two ideas that I've been floating around for a while, and I'm just trying to not force that, because I think that sometimes we can get in this thing where I need to have all the scripts on deck and people are going to say, what's your next thing? If I make 5 films in my life that I'm super proud of, that's fine with me. You know, I think for me, it's about the expression of the story and less about filmmaking in general.
Yes. Really what you're... Wait, also, I wanted to say, like, the amuse-bouche of the filmmaking process. Isn't that the palate cleanser thing? It's like the lemon thing. Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, I've only catered. I haven't attended to these catering places, but I think that's what they serve.
Yeah, but, I'm at the limoncello digestif phase of the meal. You know, I had a full like fettuccine Alfredo at Olive Garden with like all the breadsticks and salad. That's what this like. And I've got a full. I gotta let that all.
Yeah.
Process out.
Let it sit. Yes.
Yeah.
But I think, but in the, thank you for letting me go back to that.
No, of course.
But I think what you're talking about too is like, you can approach filmmaking or any creative industry in certain ways. You can reverse engineer and say, okay, what is the film that wants to be sold on the market? And let me do that.
Yeah.
Or, and that's valid. That is completely valid. That is an absolutely valid way to make films. There's another way, which is this kind of like intuitive visionary process that I would assign to you if you would have that assignment, which is I have a vision for something. I'm going to see where it leads. I'm going to follow it down every corner, every alleyway that it turns into. And I'm going to let myself be led that way. And I think both things can bring you to an outcome of a career or sustainability or gratification. Like you can reach those goals, but I think what I'm hearing you say is, you know, just in ways that we've talked with other filmmakers before, like I think what you're describing is a process that doesn't have to be gamified, that can be strategic, mm-hmm. that can be technical, that can be pragmatic and attached to reality, but that can also have this like bit of visionary mystery to it that can also lead you forward. And maybe that's just what I'm hearing today because that's what I want to hear. But I see you making this movie and thinking, what a feat.
I like all the things you're saying, Courtney, about like the two different approaches. And even when you're inside this intuitive, visionary one, there's going to be points of real anxiety and not knowing, right?
Yeah.
That anxiety doesn't only live with the practical approach. It lives here too. And it's sort of how you, it's actually, I think we keep getting back to Courtney. It's like what you do with that anxiety.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In the moment, it allows you to like move forward and take the next step. But not see the anxiety is like, oh, I shouldn't, it's not a red light.
I think that I'm very comfortable in the unknown. And I don't know if comfortable is the word, but I am very, I can operate in it. I don't know. There's something where it doesn't feel so scary to me. For example, I would love to be a Morning Pages person. This morning, you know, I watched the holdovers last night at the Alamo. I had a couple of beers and a whole pizza. I woke up. I was like, I need to put on eye patches. We're going to be on video. I'm going to have a couple cigarettes and drink a coffee. I would love to tell you that. But it shifts. Some days I get up and I'm meditating and it's a different thing. But I think that my approach to life is intuitive. However, I don't think that unless you are partnered with someone who is not that way, that you can exist exclusively that way, which is kind of what we're all getting onto here. And I was talking to my partner about this a couple of weeks ago, and she said, you don't have to know the next thing right now. You don't. Because the way that you work, from her experience, her perception of me, is that as soon as you decide that you're going to do it, it's very quick from the decision of now I'm going forward to when it's done. I mean, when we decided that we were going to make Anchorage from a short to a feature, that we started writing the short film in March of 2019 and the feature script was done in November and we shot in January. We were wrapped on production 5 days later and finished 5 months later. Like less than a year, we were completely done with the film. And I think that for me, that's what it is of, I live in that intuitive space, find what's guiding me to where I want to go, try to applicate the practical elements throughout that intuitive process. And then when I decide that it's time, then you've got to put your fucking foot on the pedal and push it, because that is your job as a director and the producers also, is to get them in the car and everyone is driving in that same direction and finding those people that are going to be driving in that direction with you, with that, at least some version of that energy and excitement about your project.
This is me really going LA right now. And I am New York City all the way, baby. But LA, I wonder what your human design is. Do you know human design?
I don't.
Okay.
But
wait, you guys,
what was that?
What'd you say?
I said, Courtney, people just stopped listening.
No, well, no, people are very into this.
Yeah. Our cinematographer was talking to me about this really cool ancient. It's almost like they use the actual deck of cards, so the Eight of Clubs, the Nine of Clubs, and those kind of things. Mm-hmm. And there are people based on your date of who you are and what your design is. And mine is an Eight of Diamonds or something like that. I'm not entirely sure, but when she told me what it meant, and there's like a bigger reading you can do about it, building a team, making things happen, understanding and navigating money really well. I was like, oh yeah, that kind of feels aligned. I think it's important to understand outside of filmmaking and is to understand like who you are is so important, because you need to know how you work, whether that's it should be through therapy and other things as well, but just self-analysis and also rigorous analysis of how you treat other people and what people's reception is towards you, you know, yes, to make sure that what I feel like I am on set, is that how people feel? What I want, what I'm intending people to feel on set, is that how they actually feel? And you can't get lost in the weeds I don't know. A lot is happening, but it's important to understand what type of creator you are, what are your strengths, and how to use those in a way that's going to benefit not only you, but your project and how you work.
And to that point, you can't know those things. You can't know all of those things until you get your boots on the ground and do it. Like until you actually make that work, right? There's a lot that you can't know about yourself.
Well, I think, yes, when you look back, it is easier to see than it is to look forward. It's easier to see where you've come from rather than where you're going. I was listening to Noam's episode on yours because I actually just did was on his podcast a couple weeks ago. And
so amazing.
I went to look on your podcast and I was like, oh my God, no, I got to listen to this because he interviewed me.
Great.
And we don't get as much of the back and forth, but you know, he looks back and he was building forts and creating Disneyland in Canada, which, you know, he was creating and finding that his voice was, I'm going to figure out how to do this on my own, you know?
Right.
And I think that's really cool to, when I look back at my life, I can see, oh, the captain of the soccer team or the football team, a leadership position, these things about growing up on a military base and being in ROTC and like these kind of elements of my life that led me to where I'm at. Especially with making this film, how those applied into strengths in the film and where those weaknesses were and how I want to differ from that going forward.
Sometimes we tell stories about we tell ourselves stories about ourselves in ways that are really self-critical. And I really like
yes.
that you assembled the one about yourself in a way that was just really helpful and also, you know, I think supportive.
I used to say for a long time, I'm a child of divorce. It was like something that I would say to to get out of a lot of stuff, sometimes long-term commitments of certain relationships or perceptions on certain things or why I was sensitive to certain things and then it becomes something that I'm saying more than anything else. First off, I'm not a child. And that was something that I realized it like the further I got away from it, it was like, dude, that happened when you were 15. You're 30 years old. It still is impactful and lives in your body as a lived experience. I'm not saying that it is not something that I still don't think about. But I think that 15 years of saying that is what I am, I would like to start over and say I am a strong, independent, supportive, loving, whatever those things are, and say those to yourselves. Because the comparison psychology is so hard, especially in filmmaking. And I was listening to the A24 podcast and I was listening to in the podcast, but I think it was Bong Joon-ho was talking about his storyboarding. And I was watching at the Alamo and I was like, I don't have any storyboards for my movie. What am I doing? So I went home and I went to the art store and got like a book and just started drawing what I was seeing for these shots. I got a little bit of the way through the film and then I realized like how hard it was to draw the interior of a car so many times. Believably, because I get into the details. And but what's funny is that I showed I basically was like, okay, this process maybe is not for me. But I showed the initial stuff to our cinematographer and it was helpful for her to see even the version that I gave. Because it's one thing to communicate what you want and it's another that somebody understands completely what you're saying, what you mean. That's so hard. There's so much. I think it's like 25 or like around that range of percentage of full understanding of what someone is trying to speak through the way that we talk and language
now.
Oh, that
makes so much sense.
Watching in the car, I actually noticed that in the beginning of the movie. I love, there's a section where they're going back and forth and the camera's in the back seat. And it's just, I love that. I thought it was really, really wonderful to watch.
Yeah. Speaking of cinematography, Erin, that was her idea in that scene. She didn't even realize well, what she said to me is that she didn't even realize she was doing it. She was just so in the scene. She was following the action, which is why it's kind of cool, because you go back to one person, you realize that the other one's still going. She also had the idea at the end of the film to keep the camera inside of the car during that whole scene. And those were ideas that she came to us with that were just incredible. Even the scene where they're pretending that there's fake neighbors out the window through, and that was, we had some time and she was like, hey, I have this idea. What if you guys were just improvise, you know, playing a game, like you're going to, like, as we go. And we did it, and we did one take each, and that was it. But, you know, with that filming, we didn't use a car mount because that would take time to put it on and off, camera risk of that for reliability. And then also having somebody to do that on set would be another mouth to feed and another person to house. So we made the creative decision. And this is one of my favorite tips to tell people is that for us, everything had to have more than just one reason. We can't just do something because of money. We can't just do something because it would look cool. Or we can't just do something because that's what Tarantino did. It's like, you need to find, for us, it was, does it cover story? Does it cover character? Does it cover these other things as well? It should have at least three, where it's like, well, this is a budget decision. We can't have this car mount, but can we make it a point of the story? Yes, because we want it to feel like you're in the car with them. So that works in a practical sense. It works in a budgetary sense, and it also works in a story and a character sense. And then that character, that camera became a character of the film. It became, Erin called her Joni, is what she named herself, this character, the name of their mother. And that she was watching these boys, which was our intention in our early conversations, was like, what would it look like for a mother who has passed away to see her sons just going down and down in this hole and having nothing that she can do about it? And for me personally, it was like, when I said that I shared these experiences and these dark experiences that I've had in my life with drugs and alcohol and substance abuse and legal problems and all that stuff, there is the version of the story that I tell my mom, which is the spark notes, you know? And then there's the lived in, the fear, the terror, the pain, the violence. That's something that, how can you fully express that?
Scott, this was such a great conversation, I think, with like really practical things and really, you know, again, intuitive things. What would you say to a filmmaker who is starting out, who maybe wants to make their first feature and is, you know, maybe feeling a little touch of that anxiety that you talked about?
Well, I think it really... When you think about what you're trying to do with a project, a feature film can be, when we were talking about distribution specifically, I met a filmmaker that does grindhouse movies. He's based somewhere in Texas, I think. And he makes his films, submits to festivals, and then releases them on VHS. That's it. On his own. Just makes the VHSs and then releases, you know, and that's how he makes films. But he's made like six grindhouse features. It's not necessarily my genre, but I can appreciate the artistry of it and the expression. I have a friend, Chris Carney, that made a comedy mockumentary and released it on YouTube and put it on his own website. It's a feature as well. And just said, pay a dollar if you can. He's now built his YouTube following to having 100,000 subscribers, and maybe some of those people watch that film. So I think that there is in the self-comparison thing as well, we're looking at these master filmmakers. And I think that sometimes that can keep us from just releasing or just making the art. And there's so many ways to release it. So I would say, like, make the project. You know, and you can make films. I have a friend that makes films for $10,000, Pete Oz. He's made four films since I've known him. He makes them every year. And he's had great festival success and released in that way. And so I think the most important thing to do is to just make your film in whatever way that you can. If you want to do the long route and you want to get a big name attached and you want to develop it with a studio or something, that's going to take some time for sure. And maybe that's something that you work on the side. And then maybe there's something that you can make right away. You know, you can make a movie in a one-shot film that's mm-hmm. a 60-minute film or a 70-minute film at one location that you have, like a house party or something. I don't know. And you can do that on your own. And so less about, you know, maybe even just feature is that I wish that I wouldn't have, well, this is, that's, that can get difficult to say. I wish I would have done this differently, but I would say that don't wait. Don't wait for anybody to give you the yes. Don't wait for the approval from a festival to get in. There are so many ways that you can self-distribute, self-release. You can, I've heard about people that take their movie in a van around the country and take it on tour like a band. The possibilities are endless, and it just comes up to you to be creative and set your goals for what you want. But first, you have to make the movie. So just go out there and do it.
Amen to that. Well, speaking of your movie, where can people watch it? Where can people follow along with you? Tell us how to find you on the World Wide Web.
Yeah. So our social media for the movie is at Anchorage Movie, and that's TikTok, X, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and my personal one is Chips Ahoy Junkie. Dakota's is at Dakota Loesch. And the movie is out to be watched anywhere online. Right now it's on YouTube, Vudu, Fandango, Redbox, Apple, and Amazon, and Microsoft as well, if there's any Xbox players out there. And it's also available in the UK.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for listening to today's bonus episode of The Break Breakdown. If you haven't already, sign up for the Queen's Bird List, a weekly digest curated for curious, creative, ambitious minds making indie art. You can find the link to sign up in our show notes. And you can follow us and find us on social at Queen's Bird Films and at The Break Breakdown. Season 3 of The Break Breakdown is made possible through the generous support of Eddie and Wendy Shaw. Special thanks to Craig, L, and Ren Hansen. You can watch Kinsley Versus now on YouTube, and The Break Breakdown is a project of Queen's Bird Films.